Welcome to Georgetown University's Oklahoma Medicaid Report Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. Please note this call is being recorded. I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Phyllis Jordan from Georgetown University Center for Children and Families.
Thank you so much. And thank you everyone for joining us today for our call about the work requirement proposal that Oklahoma has put forward for parents who rely on Medicaid or Sooner Care. We've got a great lineup of speakers today. We're going to start off with our Executive Director, Joan Alker, who will open the call with some national context and as well as some of the details about what the Oklahoma waiver request does and doesn't say about the impact in Oklahoma. Carly Putnam, who's the Policy Director at the Oklahoma Policy Institute, will give us more detail about how these policies will affect some of Oklahoma's poorest families. We're going to hear from Dr. Nathan Valentine, who's Chief Medical Officer of Variety Care, and he'll give us a perspective from a community health center and a family physician. And then we'll hear from Jeff Reams, who's an emergency medicine physician and vice president of emergency medicine for Mercy Health Systems, and he'll give us a view from the emergency room in the hospitals. So after they speak, we'll open it up for questions. So I'll turn it over to Joan now.
Thanks, Phyllis, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Again, my name is Joan Alker, and I'm the Executive Director of the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, and I'm also a research professor here at the McCourt School of Public Policy. I'm going to provide a quick overview for you of the national landscape on Medicaid waivers today and then review the findings of our new report. So on January 11th of this year, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also known as CMS, released guidance announcing its interest in approving state proposals to impose a work requirement on Medicaid beneficiaries. Since then, Federal CMS has approved four waivers that do impose work requirements, along with other barriers to coverage, such as lockouts, which we're not really talking about today. But CMS has approved waivers for Kentucky, Indiana, Arkansas, and New Hampshire. Now, it's worth noting that one thing all four of those states have in common is that they've accepted the Affordable Care Act Medicaid funding to expand their program to adults below 138% of the federal poverty line. Of course, Oklahoma has not accepted that funding. As many of you know, a federal judge recently put a hold on Kentucky's plans and sent that waiver back to federal CMS for reconsideration. However, Arkansas is the first state to go ahead and begin implementing its work requirement and other barriers on its expansion population, and that started on June 1st, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But the important point here to recognize from an Oklahoma perspective is that federal CMS has yet to respond to a state's request to impose a work requirement from a state like Oklahoma that has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. That's what we're releasing this report about today. In states that have not expanded Medicaid, these proposals are squarely targeted only at families, very low-income families with children, some of the most vulnerable in the country. A few other states, Mississippi being the most prominent example, have similar requests pending before the federal government. Alabama has another request, and that's currently open for state comment. South Dakota and South Carolina have also released proposals similar to Oklahoma. So let's talk about Oklahoma's proposal now. Oklahoma's proposal seeks to impose a work or community service requirement on parents with incomes at or below 45% of the federal poverty line. These are families whose income is no more than $779 a month for a family of three. And the state itself projects that the vast majority of parents who would be impacted by this new proposal directly, because they wouldn't be exempt, are extremely low income, below 20% of the poverty line, or just $346 a month. parents of children under 6 years old are exempt, as are other categories, but how that process of exemption would actually happen is not clear. That's one of the concerns about the proposal. And even more troubling, the state asserts that the proposal would have no impact on enrollment or spending, even though it's clear that they want to reduce enrollment. They simply don't provide that information, and that is problematic from a transparency or lack of transparency perspective. So with respect to the substance of the proposal, supporting very poor mothers and helping them to find work is a good objective that we could all agree with, but this proposal will not achieve that goal. There are no new resources identified to address barriers to employment that these mothers face, like childcare, job training, or transportation. Also, it's important to note, as our report points out, the counties where adults are enrolled in Medicaid at the highest rates are also those counties with the highest unemployment numbers, especially rural counties. So the areas likely to be hardest hit by this proposal are those rural counties. 9 out of the 10 counties with the highest unemployment rates are rural counties, and most of those have a higher percent of adults enrolled in Medicaid than in Oklahoma's average enrollment in Medicaid overall. So the practical effect of Oklahoma's proposal, we believe, will be to take away Medicaid coverage from these very poor parents, either because they get tripped up in a bureaucratic maze and don't get an exemption they're supposed to, or because they fail to comply with the new work requirement, which may be because they're simply unaware of it. This is not idle speculation, but it's reinforced by the first round of data released by Arkansas last month. As I mentioned, Arkansas is the first state to implement a work requirement. In Arkansas, Medicaid beneficiaries can only submit their information online through a complex account system they must interact with. Many of these beneficiaries do not have access to the internet, and for the first month, almost three-quarters of those required to do so did not take any action online. These large numbers suggest that beneficiaries are unaware of or unable to comply with the new system, and after 3 months of noncompliance, they will begin losing coverage, and that will be thousands of Arkansans if these trends continue. In Oklahoma, many, if not most, of these parents who lose Medicaid are likely to become uninsured because the prevalence of employer-sponsored insurance in Oklahoma for low-wage workers is very low. Only 11% of low-wage workers with earned income below the poverty line have employer-sponsored insurance. So who are these families? So our data analysis shows that in Oklahoma, more than three-quarters, 78%, are mothers. 39% of these parents are under age 30. They're most likely to be white, just under two-thirds are white, but African-Americans are disproportionately represented at 19% as compared to the state population of Oklahoma. As I mentioned before, these families are more likely to live in rural areas and small towns. 7% of those impacted are likely to be American Indians. Although the proposal seeks to allow them to opt out, it's not clear if CMS will allow this. Now, most importantly, the vast majority, 85% of these parents have been in the workforce or have a family member that has been in the workforce over the past 6 months. I'd like to close my remarks by pointing out that children will also be harmed if their parents lose coverage. Research is very clear that being uninsured raises the risk for parents and children to not be able to access the health services they need. There are three key reasons why children are at risk. As their parents become uninsured, the entire family is at risk for medical debt and even bankruptcy, moving these families in the opposite direction of economic self-sufficiency. Families at this income level already experience very high levels of homelessness and residential instability, as well as higher rates of health problems. Secondly, it stands to reason that a healthier parent is a better parent. For example, Medicaid has been shown clearly to reduce the incidence of depression, and maternal depression is epidemic among very low-income women. This inhibits parent-child bonding in the critical early years of development. And finally, the research is clear that as parents become uninsured, children are more likely to become uninsured as well. An insured parent almost never has an uninsured child. But a parent not having insurance raises the odds the child, too, will be uninsured. This is particularly troubling in Oklahoma, which already has one of the highest uninsured rates for children in the country. At 7.3%, Oklahoma's rate is considerably higher than the national average of 4.5% of uninsured children. And with that, I will hand it back to Phyllis.
Thanks, Joan. Carly, can you talk to us something about what's going on the ground in Oklahoma?
Yeah, sure. So we know, I'm Carly Putnam, I'm the policy director at Oklahoma Policy Institute. I also handle the majority of our healthcare research. And what we know is that cutting health coverage for parents who don't meet a work requirement is going to harm Oklahoma families. Most people on Medicaid who can work do work. And as Joan said, the group that this proposal would apply to is basically very low-income mothers, and most of whom who live in rural areas. And while the proposal seeks to exclude the parents of children under age six, we know that low-wage work doesn't line up right with school hours. It's not from 8 to 3 on a weekday. It's all hours of the day. It's late into the evening. It's weekends. And it's incredibly inconsistent. And so what this means is that these moms who are doing exactly what they're supposed to do, they're supposed to be working, and who want to be working are going to get ensnared in this. And when they do, they're going to lose their health coverage. And then, you know, if they manage to come back into compliance, then they'll reapply. And then if they aren't able to meet the requirement, they'll lose the coverage again. And this becomes a kind of cruel, inefficient system that is not going to help Oklahoma families achieve better health or work more. And it just means that a lot of very low-income moms are going to spend more time trying to figure out a government bureaucracy. We also know that adults, the group of people that this proposal could apply to on Sooner Care who aren't working, have what we would consider pretty solid reasons for not working. They're raising children. They're looking after a sibling with a disability. They're taking care of aging parents. They themselves have a chronic health condition or a disability. And in some cases, we know that some of these people would probably qualify for an exemption, but we have no way of knowing what that process would be or who in practice would qualify. The proposal seeks to exempt caregivers for an incapacitated individual, but there's no definition of what that would actually mean. And so that's deeply, deeply concerning. And above all, we know in Oklahoma what we need to move people into the workforce or into better jobs. We know that they need child care, they need elder care, they need transportation, and they need expanded access to treatment for mental illness and substance use disorders, not a rollback of it. I don't have children. My friends who have children, even the comfortably middle-class friends with children, describe locating and paying for childcare as kind of a nightmare. We know that the number of childcare facilities in the state is declining and that participation in the childcare subsidy available to very low-income parents is also declining. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Some families don't live where the subsidized childcare centers are. Some can't find care that fits this irregular nights and weekends work schedule. And some still can't afford the copays, which can be quite high for families in deep poverty. And so the sort of implication of this proposal is that parents should be leaving their 10-year-olds at home on a weekend while they go and work. And I don't think we want that for our children. We also know that the people this proposal would apply to are increasingly taking care of aging parents. They're not just taking care of their children, though. They're also taking care of their mothers and fathers. And there's some geographical aspects to this, too. As Joan mentioned, in some counties, particularly Okmulgee, Pushmataha, McIntosh, we've got both very high unemployment rates and high shares of adults who use Sooner Care to see a doctor or fill up a prescription. And something we know about Oklahoma is that sometimes people just don't live where the jobs are, or what jobs are available are not actually available to the people who need work, whether it's a skills mismatch or no access to transportation. And unfortunately, cutting health coverage for parents who don't meet a work requirement doesn't help people get access to care, doesn't help families get ahead, and instead it creates situations that are likely to make it harder for Oklahoma families to really get their feet under them. The Oklahoma legislature has recently become really engaged in conversations around adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs recently, which are childhood traumas that can inform the trajectory of an entire life. And Oklahoma tends to have a rather high share of people who've had a fair number of these childhood traumas. And along with witnessing a parent experiencing violence or having a parent be incarcerated, one adverse childhood experience is having a parent with an untreated illness. We already have too many kids who are struggling to thrive in poverty and neglect, and making it harder for their parents to responsibly manage conditions like diabetes or asthma or depression is not going to help these kids out. It's going to harm them. We can also, as Joan mentioned, expect that we'll have people who will manage to work more to comply with this requirement, but in the process, they could work themselves out of Sooner Care eligibility. So for a family of three, the cutoff is 45% of the federal poverty level, what sociologists would call deep poverty, just shy of $800 a month for that family. And if the mom in that family earns $850 a month or $10,000 a year for her family of three, that mom's going to lose her health coverage because she won't qualify for Sooner Care anymore, but she also probably won't have other options. Most low-wage jobs don't come with employer coverage, and Insure Oklahoma is only available for some people who work at some businesses, many of which are not low-wage jobs. Because Oklahoma didn't expand Medicaid, she'll be in the coverage crater where she won't qualify for Sooner Care, but she also won't qualify for help buying coverage on healthcare.gov. So for a lot of parents, this is going to wind up being a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And research from multiple states shows that for people who aren't working, getting health insurance helps them to get a job. And for people who are working, getting health insurance helps them to keep that job. And this proposal instead moves in the opposite direction. The Healthcare Authority has this proposal available on their website at okhca.org/work requirements, and there's an opportunity there for public comment. The public comments on this are incredibly important. They will help shape policy by alerting policymakers to what constituent concerns are about this issue. In the case of the Kentucky litigation, public comments were cited by the judge who struck down the waiver. These comments do carry a lot of weight, and people have until September 3rd to comment, and we very much hope that they will.
Thank you very much, Carly. Dr. Valentine, can you tell us about your experiences?
Hi, yes. Thank you, Carly and Joan, for those good points. I would say that my experience on the ground as a family physician has shown me the reality of that background information you just provided. So my background is a family medicine physician at Variety Care in Oklahoma City, and I am also the chief medical officer and the clinical advisor for the Oklahoma Primary Care Association. So I've had exposure to not only my own community health center, but community health centers around the state and the challenges that the primary care providers are facing. I think what would be helpful is to look at an example. So if we looked at a single mother with one child who was working a minimum wage job, 80 hours a month, then she would meet the income requirement and the work requirement. But this is a minimum wage job, and what I see firsthand nearly every day in clinic is the trade-off that patients have to continuously consider. And in a minimum wage job, they're going to be asked, this mom is going to be asked sometimes to cover a shift here or there. The business is up, so you need a little more coverage, and they feel pressured to do these other things, which in some other settings might be reasonable, but she's stuck in a position where she says okay to that extra shift, even if she only works 86 hours that month, then she's going to be considered too wealthy and would lose her health care coverage. And what I would add to this to make it even more realistic is to consider the mom a diabetic and the child with asthma. In community health centers, we see adults, low-income adults and low-income children with plenty of chronic conditions. It's a very common thing, becoming more common. We tend to think of children as being in that healthy bucket, but we see an awful lot in community health center where that's not the case. You have to follow a condition like asthma or others. And what ends up happening because the mom can't accept that extra shift, she risks losing her job. The child's medications become too much to bear, and you have both mom and child heading to the ER for their primary care. Another thing to point out is that as we sometimes think of a possibility of the mother getting insurance from their employer, and only about 11% of the working poor in Oklahoma have health insurance available from their employers, so that really isn't an option. And at these income levels, there's plenty of other things that the family struggles to afford. A one-bedroom apartment, childcare, transportation, if they have access to a car, repair of it, even enough food. What we see in community health centers is we have to help with all of these things in order to meet the health outcome we're all aiming for, control that diabetes, control that asthma, in a primary care setting where it's best for patient and family and best for the system because it's the most cost-effective place to treat those conditions. So the result really that you get with the proposed policy change here is delayed primary care and a higher rate of use of more expensive settings. Now, I'd like to underscore the rural distinction as well. If this mom and child are living in a small town in Oklahoma, which many do, then there's actually a heavier reliance upon Medicaid coverage. More parents are covered by Medicaid in the rural setting, more children are covered by Medicaid in the rural setting compared to the urban. And on top of that, jobs are not as available in the rural setting, and even the ER they're going to go to because they can't get into primary care, in this example, even that ER is a town or two over. So you're talking about just adding an awful lot of bad and worse choices for mom that I feel could be avoided. Another point I wanted to make about this is that if this goes into effect as stated, it's going to directly work against my ability as a family physician to hit the quality marks I'm held accountable for. So there are very specific things I'm supposed to do for a diabetic, very specific things I'm supposed to do for an asthmatic, because those are the right things to do to help the child and mother live a fulfilling long life. With fewer touches because they can't afford to visit, even at our sliding fee scale rates for folks without insurance, we have to weigh that every single visit. Talking about the follow-up plan, talking about the treatment plan always includes, okay, can you afford the next visit? Can you afford this medicine or that one? And this will just make that conversation even longer and even more complex. The other thing to point out is that right now in Oklahoma, we are working very hard to put the Opioid Commission's recommendations into place. And with fewer touches, as a family physician, I'm not going to be able to catch the behavioral health conditions and the addiction early enough, or the risk factors for addiction early enough, to be able to make a difference in that person's life. The current suggested exemptions only include active substance use treatment, which is really a very small corner of the group of patients that we would need to consider. So that's, I think that specific example helps to kind of bring it into concrete terms about what this looks like on the ground. In our health center, we have pediatricians also, and they're concerned about how we're defining children with chronic conditions or incapacitated, because that's a general term. I would add that that's a level of ambiguity that also is unhelpful. And I think we're going to find that if this goes into play, we're going to have fewer kids and fewer families seeking enough care that we can actually meet their needs. And in the end, not only does the family pay for that, but the society pays for that with a higher level of costs, because there really is no more cost-effective place to go for that care.
Great. Thanks very much. That's really helpful. Dr. Reams, can you tell us about your perspective from the emergency room?
Sure, I'll be happy to. Appreciated the previous comments from Dr. Valentine. We'll talk talk a little bit more about those. I'm an emergency medicine physician. I live in Oklahoma. I oversee the 9 emergency departments that Mercy has in Oklahoma. Mercy is a nonprofit healthcare system that operates hospitals in 4 states. Like I mentioned, we have 9 hospitals in Oklahoma. 8 of those are in rural areas in Oklahoma. So I think it's important to remember the previous comments about how the rural areas are disproportionately affected here. So I can speak to, from an emergency department perspective, what's going to happen. And as Joan and Carly have fairly eloquently put this, people are going to lose their insurance coverage. As a result of this, there's going to be people that will lose their coverage. There's a very predictable thing that what happens in society and in healthcare when people lose their coverage, they don't have any coverage. They go one place for their healthcare then, and they tend to come to the emergency departments. I think Dr. Valentine articulated that previously. And so these patients, they're not going to have access to healthcare anywhere else, so they're going to come to our ERs, and you know we're happy to see them. That's what we're in the business for. But several things happen when they're forced to come to the ER for healthcare, and this is not really unique to Oklahoma. This is present in other states and just in our industry. There are several issues with that. The first issue is that we do our best in the emergency department, but it's episodic care. It's not really good at promoting the health of a population. And I think Dr. Valentine really nicely articulated this population needs a lot of help in optimizing their healthcare outcomes. And we can't do that with a very episodic care in the ED. The other issue with people being forced to come to the ED is it's exponentially more expensive to provide care in an ED compared to other outpatient clinic settings where a lot of these issues could be addressed. I want to so those are kind of, from an emergency department point of view, those are kind of what's going to happen. This is very predictable, and this is what will happen if this is instituted. I want to talk about just a little more granular level of the types of patients that we're going to see. And I think Carrie did a nice job of this, and I think Dr. Valentine, I think we all understand who these patients are and the lives that these patients are trying to live. So the typical patient that we're going to see in our rural EDs is going to be a single mother with children, and either the mother's going to become ill, or the children will be ill or be injured, and they'll come to the ED. They will be forced to probably wait longer than the average patient because their symptoms are maybe less acute, and we are taking care of other more acute patients first, as an ER typically does. So they'll come. There will be, mom will likely be involved in some type of work-related activity that she'll have to take off because either herself or her children are ill. They bring them to the ER. We'll see them. We'll do what's necessary to help them, probably provide prescriptions, of which they may or may not be able to afford. A lot of times we try to use the cheapest, most cost-effective treatment we can, but sometimes they may not be able to afford the prescriptions that we write, and then we will tell them we'll do what we can, prescribe what medicines we can, and then they will need to follow up with another doctor to make sure that they're getting better, and we're sending them out without the real ability for good follow-up care. And as we've talked about, in maintaining the health of a population, that follow-up care is so important They have none. So those are specifically the kind of things that are going to happen when we see this occur in Oklahoma and in across all of our EDs. So thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you so much. That's really interesting. We're going to open it up for questions now. I'm going to start with a question for Joan Alker. When do you expect you'll see some action from the Trump administration on proposals like the one that Oklahoma's put forward?
So, as I mentioned earlier, Mississippi is probably, in my judgment, the first state where the federal government may render judgment on this. At the time that the judge ruled in the Kentucky case, he sent it back to the federal CMS. CMS responded by reopening a public comment period for Kentucky. That very same day, they also reopened the public comment period for Mississippi. And both of those comment periods, federal periods, end August 18th. So I suspect they're trying to strengthen the record so that they can go ahead and approve Mississippi. And so that could be relatively early in the fall. They have also sent Alabama back out for comment. So I can see a number of trends here. Another disturbing trend I want to mention, and this is true in Oklahoma's proposal, but as folks who followed Kentucky know, one of the key issues there was the loss of coverage. And Kentucky's waiver documents, when you do some very simple math, showed that 95,000 people would lose coverage by the fifth year. That became an important issue in the case. In Oklahoma's proposal, as I mentioned, the state contradicts itself in the proposal. At one point in the proposal, they clearly state that they expect to see enrollment decline as a result of this proposal. But yet when they are talking about the impact on enrollment and spending as part of the budget neutrality agreement, they say there won't be any. So that's a very troubling concern. I'm worried, we've seen this in a couple of other states, that states are trying to hide the ball here with respect to potential enrollment losses that we all know will happen.
Do we have any questions from the reporters?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone keypad. If you find your question has been addressed, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. And we will take our first question from Joyce Frieden. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Joyce Frieden from MedPage Today. I'm curious on two fronts. One is why the spotlight here is on Oklahoma, if Mississippi is probably going to be the first state where action might be taken on this. And secondly, one of the presenters mentioned that children, if their parents lose coverage, they're likely to lose coverage. And so I wondered if someone could address the interplay of Medicaid and CHIP in this situation.
Okay, this is Joan Alker, Georgetown. I'm going to respond to your first question and a little bit to your second, and others can jump in. On the first question, we've already done a report on Mississippi. We issued that a few months ago when that proposal came to the federal government for comment. The Oklahoma proposal is currently up for public comment in the state, as Carly Putnam mentioned. So we've been analyzing these proposals as they emerge and go up for public comment. This is our fourth report. We've done Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, and now Oklahoma. I will say that to me, the Oklahoma proposal comes at an important time. Since I mentioned, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen the federal government reopen comments on Mississippi. We've seen some changes to Mississippi and Alabama that suggest to me that the Trump administration is trying to figure out a way to get to yes on these kinds of proposals. So I think that's very important as we see a growing number of states considering them. With respect to children, I brought up the research is very clear that there is a relationship between uninsured parents are more likely to have uninsured children. When parents drop off the program and there's publicity about new requirements in Medicaid, should this be approved, and even frankly under the consideration stage, that tends to lead to a loss of coverage due to the misinformation. Even if children are exempt, sometimes families don't know that. CHIP is serving higher income children. So the children we're talking about here are the very, very poorest kids in Oklahoma that are in Medicaid. So let me see if others want to jump in on that family dynamic issue before we take the next question.
Great, thank you.
This is Carly Putnam, OK Policy. And just to follow up on Joan's comments, the state covers kids up to a relatively high income level, but for parents, 45% of poverty is it. So as to sort of reiterate Joan's comments, these are going to be incredibly low-income families who there may be some misunderstanding, some misinformation, incomplete information, and who kids may lose coverage as a result.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next question.
Yes, our next question will be from Meg Wingarder with the New Oklahoman. Please go ahead.
Hello. You've laid out quite a lot of concerns with the waiver as it stands. Is there anything that could be done with this this waiver to offset some of those concerns about impact on families, or in a non-expansion state, do you not see any way forward for something like this?
So this is Joan Alkert-Rush, and I'm going to quickly respond to that, and I want others to jump in. So I will say, from my perspective, as somebody who's looked at Medicaid policy for quite a long time now, this is not a proposal that can be fixed. It really should be dropped. And what's unique about this proposal and similar proposals is that they are conditioning Medicaid eligibility upon compliance with the work requirement. This is a new, we've never seen this before in the history of the Medicaid program, which is over 50 years old, and that's the rub. There are states, for example, Montana, which has expanded Medicaid, but did institute a new program that linked Medicaid beneficiaries to job training and services. And that makes a world of sense to me. And if Oklahoma wanted to go in that direction, that would make sense. But this proposal at the end of the day, unfortunately, is really not about that. It's really about reducing enrollment because there are no new resources to help these families find jobs. And the critical distinction is that their Medicaid eligibility is conditioned. It is linked to and to these new requirements. And to me, that's the problem. So it really makes it a punishment rather than a proposal that will provide the needed supports to help these families move out of poverty, which is very hard to do. So let me also ask my colleagues in Oklahoma to jump in on that.
Carly Putnam with OK Policy. And Joan, I was going to mention Montana, too. The Montana model, I think, is a far more effective way to do what this proposal claims to want to do. I think it's also worth noting that, you know, the healthcare authority didn't decide out of the blue they wanted to do this. There were instructions from the governor and the legislature. And I believe, just given the list of exemptions, the intent is to try to ensure that the most vulnerable of this incredibly vulnerable group aren't harmed, but intent is not the same as impact. And without having more detail, it's really difficult to know how bad this could actually be for Oklahoma families.
Anybody else want to jump in on that?
Okay. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
This is Dr. Valentine in Oklahoma City. I just wanted to say that the concept, and I'm afraid I'm not familiar with Montana's model, so I don't know if this is the direction they went or not, but the concept of making health insurance contingent upon work is a puzzling one on the front lines of care, because what we see is if patients and their families are able to get in a timely fashion, something we strive for as their patient-centered medical home, if they're able to get in and have access to care, then they actually are more likely to keep their jobs and sometimes even work more hours. So from my perspective, it seems a little puzzling to go at it from this direction, especially without any other extra supports in place. When you talk about finding work, you would need to talk about the barriers to finding work, which, you know, I didn't necessarily go to medical school to learn those things, but I've learned that's the secret to really getting good health outcomes, and is understanding the social determinants that are really affecting that the patient's life and how they can work and get into your office. So I think there's just a kind of a logical mismatch here if you consider experience on the ground.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And there's a new study out today from the Kaiser Family Foundation that summarizes a lot of literature on this and really makes that exact same point, which is that access to health insurance is actually going to help folks work. So in essence, this policy is putting that backwards. Do we have any other questions?
We do not have any further questions in queue. Would we like to wait another moment or turn it back to our presenters for closing comments?
Wendy, do you want to just remind folks of how to ask a question and then take a minute?
Yes. To ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we will pause just a moment to allow any questions to queue.
And while we're waiting, I'll say that this report is on our website, and we'll also, within 24 hours, have a tape of this call on our website. So, and if you're interested in our other reports, you'll find them too. Mississippi, Alabama, and South Carolina are also up on our website.
And our website, ccf.georgetown.edu.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, so I don't see any other questions, so I think we will thank all of our presenters and our attendees, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks so much for joining us.